Today we have with us Mr. Jim Dempsey, who is Vice President for Public Policy with the Center for Democracy and Technology. He's been with CDT since 1997, concentrating on internet privacy, government surveillance, and national security issues. He's authored or co-authored multiple articles on privacy and internet policy. Join me in welcoming Jim as he engages us in an enlightening conversation on internet governance. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good morning. At the outset, I want to say how much I appreciate the work that EDUCAUSE is doing in Washington, D.C., to promote the legal and policy framework that will support continued development of the internet. I'm especially pleased that EDUCAUSE is a member of Digital Due Process, which is a coalition that CDT coordinates and which is working to reform the Electronic Communications Privacy Act to set a baseline of sound privacy protection against government intrusion for information stored online, which is obviously so critical in this era of cloud computing. Today, my topic is internet governance. And I want to explain to you what internet governance is, to describe some of the threats that the current proposals in this area pose to the development of the open internet, and to conclude a few thoughts about how the higher education community is and could be engaged in this debate. So let me begin by explaining what I understand internet governance to be. Internet governance is the sum of all of the laws and regulations, norms, practices, standards that shape the evolution and the use of the internet, and the decision-making processes for developing and applying those laws, regulations, norms, standards, practices. Fundamentally, when you think about internet governance, it's about choices. How does this incredibly complex network of networks operate? Who can gain access to it? How do you get to be one of the nodes? Who can publish information? Who can access information? How can you be sure the traffic will get from one end of the network to the other? How much does access cost? What programs and services can be offered online? What device can be connected? Or what kind of product or service or functionality can be offered at any one of those nodes? What data is collected? By whom and for what purpose? What content is permitted or prohibited? So who decides these questions? Is it the U.S. government? Is it or should it be other national governments? Is it the UN or international bodies? Is it the companies that offer key services and that have policies to which we all consent when we use those services and policies that define the use of those services? Or is the internet governed by the geeks, by the people who write the code, which after all specifies how data flows and what gets from one point to another and how? This is John Postel, a computer scientist, now sadly passed away in 1998. For many years he was at USC, where he single-handedly ran the domain name system, keeping track of which addresses were assigned to which computer devices connected to the internet. And in a highly simplified version of the history of the internet, John Postel is said to be the man who governed the internet in its early days. However, even in its earliest stages, internet governance was much more complex than the assignment of names and numbers. And today, everyone would agree that the internet has evolved well beyond the era in which it seemed to be governed based upon the relationships between a handful of academics and other researchers who knew each other personally. So in answer to my question, who runs the internet, I'd like to pause for a while on this chart, because the answer to the question is all of the above, and many others as well. You have the national governments, which, for example, regulate the telecommunications providers that operate the backbone and that provide connectivity all the way down to the last mile. National governments obviously define crimes and enforce the criminal laws, which also apply, obviously, to online conduct. You have the UN-based or global intergovernmental organizations, the WTO, the WIPO, on intellectual property issues. I'll dwell at more length on the ITU, the International Telecommunication Union, which is a UN body. You have the companies operating through peering agreements, through their terms of service, through a variety of other means. You have individual users. More than any other technology, this internet technology is uniquely user-controlled in the way that people can choose what to view, what to publish, what to access. And there are the coders. Certainly at the IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force, which I'll also dwell upon, and to some extent the regional internet registries are heavily dominated by dominated in a good way by technologists. Now, two key points I think emerge from this chart. One, governance is not limited to governments. Governments have a role, but the sum and substance of internet governance should not be equated with governments. And secondly, obviously, there are lots of sources of internet governance, and always have been. Private arrangements, governmental arrangements, and I've arranged them, I tried to plot them on this axis of individual to international and no government involvement to all government, government-dominated in terms of the national regulatory authorities, the FCCs and the other regulatory bodies and the parliaments, et cetera. Now, in many ways, this system has worked very well. The internet has grown far, far faster than any other medium in history. It has achieved remarkable levels of accessibility and affordability on a global scale. The internet that this system of governance produces is characterized by competition, innovation, decentralization, openness, abundance, the ability to attach an essentially unlimited number of devices to the network, diversity, can accommodate essentially an unlimited number of speakers. So a remarkable, remarkable accomplishment in a phenomenally short period of time. However, this structure has also left us with some very serious challenges. Cybersecurity is a leading one. The continuing digital divide is felt acutely in many countries. There are questions of intellectual property enforcement, very hard questions posed by content that is offensive on religious or cultural grounds, the lack of privacy, the risk of fraud, and so on. As a result, this structure is being challenged, and we're hearing calls for new forms of internet governance coming from a variety of sources, from those genuinely concerned about cybersecurity, genuinely, legitimately saying we need to do something to address this problem. calls coming from the less developed countries concerned about being left behind in the information economy. By those concerned about the perception or reality of undue U.S. governmental control or undue dominance by U.S.-based companies, and calls for reform, for change, from repressive countries seeking to exercise more control over the flow of information, countries who see the Internet as a threat, countries like China trying to have their cake and eat it too, trying to have the economic potential without the destabilizing, democratizing potential. And we're hearing some very troubling calls for greater governmental control. Just one example coming from China, Russia, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, which in a way tells you everything you need to know about it, but a proposal to the UN for some very logical and desired necessary things: cooperation in combating criminal and terrorist activities, cooperation on cybersecurity, recognition of the global nature of the Internet. But clearly there's an agenda here that is not friendly towards innovation, not friendly towards the democratic values. Now, I want to focus on three of the many bodies that are engaged in Internet governance, but three bodies that are currently central to this debate. And I want to compare and contrast how they operate and what lessons we can learn about Internet governance. The first is the Internet Engineering Task Force, or IETF, a truly remarkable body. It is open to all participants. It has no formal membership, no fees, no dues, nothing to sign. Meetings are open to all. They don't vote. There's no voting. It's done by consensus. A running code and rough consensus is the longstanding motto of the IETF. And I could only capture the very first few of the multiple working groups that IETF manages, touching upon all of the critical issues, including the security issues and other issues central to the Internet. This is one of the an example of one of the remarkable ways in which what is so remarkable about the IETF. This is the an initial specification for TCP. One of the main roles of IETF is to sort of maintain the suite of protocols associated with TCP/IP. And this was published by Vint Cerf, one of the obviously founders of the Internet, in 1974. And what's unique, among other things, and what's very telling, is this and all other documents of the IETF, it's called a request for comments. Not a proposal even. It's not going to be a law. It's not going to be a regulation. It's not going to be binding. Just here's an interesting way to move traffic. Does anybody have any comments on this? And yet this protocol and the associated IP protocol. Here's a picture of Vint with his famous T-shirt, which is half of the slogan, IP on everything, everything on IP. But it is remarkable when you think about it that this voluntary standard, completely non-mandatory, operates on everything. Copper wire, coaxial cable, fiber optics, a wireless, and everything can be carried on IP, data, video, voice, any device that can process information working on this TCP/IP protocol. Open, all of their documents are free. Most of the work of the IETF is done online through mailing lists. They have three meetings a year where 1,000 people get together in multiple working groups. But if you participate and you know what you're talking about, you can have an impact. That's how the IETF works. And it has provided critical infrastructure, standards, the framework that has enabled the remarkable growth of this technology. And so IETF is what we would call an exemplar of the multi-stakeholder governance model. Companies send their staff to IETF. Governments can send people to IETF, but each individual participates in their own capacity, not representing their company, although clearly companies delegate or designate staff in part to work on IETF matters. But at the end of the day, if you know what you're talking about, you will be listened to, and if you don't know what you're talking about, you won't be. And that's the way the IETF operates. Now, I mentioned John Postel. And up until 1998, under a contract with the U.S. government, he ran the domain name system, essentially. By 1998, it was becoming clear that the domain name system needed to be radically changed, to be taken away from government, U.S. government dominance, and privatized, to be opened to competition, and to be globalized. And in the pursuit of those goals, ICANN was created, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, which now manages the domain name system. Again, ICANN is a unique body. It is a not-for-profit corporation resident in California and Marina Del Rey. And yet it has responsibility for the worldwide coordination of the domain name system. The domain name system is one of the few areas in Internet governance that truly needs a hierarchical, or up until now at least, has had a hierarchical structure. So when you type in iowa.edu, wherever you are in the world, you want to know that that will resolve to the computers of University of Iowa. Or when you are traveling abroad and you type in bankofamerica.com and point your browser, you want to know that each hop of that communication is getting closer and closer to the servers of Bank of America and not to somebody in Moldova. And that requires ensuring that names and numbers resolve correctly. Coca-Cola wants to know that it has control of Coca-Cola globally. So there are intellectual property issues. There are security issues. And obviously, there are core functionality issues. Now, the issue confronting ICANN is that the U.S. government has retained some limited but critical control over the function of adding new domains to this hierarchical structure. And the Department of Commerce has a contract with ICANN to run the function of managing what are called the root servers. It's a legacy of the contracts that John Postel had and USC had going back to the early days of the Internet. Now, arguably, this is an important restraint, a final sort of check on what gets added to that or what gets taken out of that hierarchical structure matching names and numbers. However, this remaining contract that the U.S. government has with ICANN remains the source globally of huge distrust of the U.S. It's sort of the core, it is the source of this argument, which I think is not true, but the source of the argument that the U.S. controls the Internet. The U.S. government has been pretty restrained about using its control over that IANA function, over that root server function. But it hasn't been totally pure on that, which has hurt the process. And now, obviously, the Snowden revelations, both on the surveillance side and even more so some of the recent revelations in terms of what the NSA has been doing with regard to cryptography and security, has further exacerbated the distrust of the U.S. government and has pushed for more pressure on ICANN to completely sever that umbilical cord that it still has with the United States. The problem is, from CDT's perspective, that ICANN has never really made it clear in a binding and accountable way what the scope of its jurisdiction is. Narrowly defined, that naming and numbering process is a technical function. You get over into the IP area and you touch on policy issues, you touch on some security issues. But until, in our view, until ICANN truly commits itself to staying with a narrow agenda and is accountable in some ways, and I believe there are ways through the traditional corporation laws to hold them to their narrow purpose, until they are willing to actually do that, there's a risk of cutting this umbilical cord, because ICANN, again, prides itself on being a multi-stakeholder organization. This is a very complicated chart of how the governance structure of ICANN itself works, and it's tried very hard to create a system in which all of the interested constituencies are represented. The commercial interests, the registries, internet users themselves, and governments. And you can see they have what they call the Government Advisory Committee. And one of the sort of unanswered questions around ICANN is, what actually is the role and power and influence of the Government Advisory Committee? ICANN was designed as what's called a bottom-up organization. It was intended to generate ideas, proposals, a little bit like IETF or like some of the other voluntary standards bodies, to generate proposals that filter up, again, through rough consensus from the various constituencies and should not be approved by the board in the absence of some general consensus among all the affected stakeholders. Some feel it hasn't worked that way, and one of the major areas of concern is the role of the Government Advisory Committee. Another major source of concern is sort of the power of the ICANN staff, which has grown dramatically as ICANN has matured. So in the next year, there will continue to be debate and controversy swirling around ICANN. Just last year, 2012, the Department of Commerce contract was extended for, I think, 3 years with a two-year possibility of a two-year extension. So I think ICANN probably feels that it has some breathing room, but it's remains a lightning rod for international concern. The third body that I want to talk about is the International Telecommunication Union. The ITU is a treaty-based body made up of governments. It actually predates the UN. It was founded in the 19th century, I think, is the International Telegraph Union, focusing at that time on telegraph, and was absorbed into the UN and is now part of the UN structure. Now, in contrast to the IETF, which doesn't even take votes, the ITU is a voting entity in which governments vote, and it's one government, one vote. Non-governmental entities can join, corporations can join, nonprofits can join, at a relatively hefty fee. We concluded that the cost was a little bit too much to join. And if you join, you still don't get to vote. You get to attend some of the closed meetings, and you get to access the documents, which are not, many of which are not available to non-members, or technically not available to non-members. There's a WikiLeaks type site for ITU documents, but you're supposed to get them through official channels. Now, for most of its history, the ITU dealt with spectrum issues, with telephone numbering issues, area codes, and with technical matters. It has a very influential broadband standard. And a lot of developing countries, less developed countries, look to the ITU as a place where they have a voice, where they get an equal vote, in essence, with the United States. Last year, the ITU met in Dubai. By the way, to join ITU, it's thousands of dollars a year, which is not necessarily prohibitive, certainly not for corporations, and even some NGOs afford that. On the other hand, you also have to bear the cost of a week and a half in Dubai, which is or 2 weeks. The plenary meetings of the ITU generally last a week or more. They met in Dubai, and in the lead-up to the meeting, you saw, again, all of these concerns about who governs the Internet coming to the fore. And you saw a number of countries coming forward and saying, we need greater control. We need a greater say. We need to take control away from the United States, and we need to exercise it. Some of those were less developed countries struggling with questions like wireless charges and mobile spam in these countries where mobile is obviously the way in which most people will, for the foreseeable future, access the Internet. So legitimate concerns, but also the security concern. And again, it's not that cybersecurity isn't a real problem. Clearly it is. And clearly governments need to work together. But you saw this effort by Russia, by China, by the Arab states, by others, to bring in concepts of security and information security and reliability and trust and cooperation and coordination, and a real concern that these countries were looking for ratification of their repressive desires, of their desires to exercise more control. At the end of the day, you don't have to try to read the names, but the treaty recommendations or the treaty amendments which came out of ITU, of the Dubai meeting, a large number of countries voted against. And I'll read off, it's interesting to see who voted for the treaty. The ending treaty was really, in many ways, not that bad. But it did have some still references of concern to cybersecurity, which some people feared was a code word for a tighter governmental controls over information flows. And you had an interesting split. So clearly, China, Russia, a lot of the Arab states voted yes in green. And U.S., many of the European countries voted no. So Germany and Austria and United States and so on voted no. What's interesting is Gambia voted no, and Kenya voted no, and Malawi voted no. And these are the countries that are sort of in the middle. They see this debate between the United States on the one hand, often in concert with Europe, and Russia, China on the other hand. And there are these countries in the middle who are genuinely torn as to which way to go. They hear some of the rhetoric coming out of China and Russia, which talks about inequality, which has an anti-American sort of undertone to it, which talks about digital divide, which talks about the need for more equal distribution of the benefits of the information economy. And these countries in the middle are attracted to that. On the other hand, they do see the value of innovation and entrepreneurship and openness and the democratic and participatory and human development potential of the internet. And in any one of those countries, there is a sort of a tug of war between the voices for more control and the voices for openness, for innovation, for entrepreneurship, for the more traditional approach to internet governance. None of the debates at the ITU are ended. These issues are going to come up again and again and again and again. Unfortunately, of course, the U.S. has, which entered WICCET already in a hole because it really wasn't listening to the concerns of the developing and transitional countries, the U.S. is now even further in a hole as a result of recent disclosures, and has lost even further ability to argue in favor of the current model and against the more the model that would give greater power to other governments. So here's the landscape that we have. And as we go forward, it's going to be important to consider what are the problems facing the internet today, what are the existing institutions working on those problems, and what are the best ways to address them? We have to ask what needs to be subject to centralized control, what needs to be or is appropriate for governmental control, and what is best dealt with on a decentralized basis, and what can be handled without governmental controls. The domain name system, for example, as it's currently functioning and currently conceived, does need to be centralized. It needs to have, in my view, central coordination. But it does not need to be governmental. And ICANN has proven that the non-governmental, private, multi-stakeholder model for domain governance works, you know, just like democracy. It's the worst. ICANN is probably the worst body you could imagine to run the domain name system, except for all the others. On the other hand, the enforcement of criminal law regarding fraud or hacking is by its nature governmental. Technical standards can help. Best practices can help. Informed consumers are an important part of the picture, but at the end of the day, there will be crime online, and that is largely the purview of governments and largely the purview of national governments with cross-border cooperation. Peering agreements need be neither centralized nor dictated by government. And overall, I think the center of gravity for internet governance should remain in the multi-stakeholder bodies. And a multi-stakeholder body should be judged by the extent to which it is open, participatory, democratic in the sense that each participant has an equal voice, and voluntary in terms of its product, in terms of its output. Now, what can higher education do? Already, you're doing a lot. Many of your colleagues, perhaps some of you as well, but certainly many of your colleagues in the computer science departments are already participants in IETF working groups. A number of university-based people participate in ICANN. I would suggest, and I'm just throwing this out, but I would suggest, if it isn't already, that EDUCAUSE consider joining ITU and begin following that and participating in that, if only to help prevent things from going in the wrong direction there. It's going to take a massive cooperative effort of civil society, of governments that understand the open entrepreneurial innovation-based model of corporations. It's going to take all of us working together to continue promoting the decentralized multi-stakeholder model of governance, and our voices need to be at the ITU through all of its meetings. CDT is coordinating a group of NGOs mainly around the world. I'm particularly interested in hearing from any of you from outside the United States who would like to be part of that network, because this cannot just be, obviously, a U.S.-led effort, particularly given the fact that we're in a little bit of a hole, credibility-wise, globally. So the internet has always been based on rough consensus and running code. Every day, to some extent, the rules are being reconsidered. The technology is being redesigned. But I do believe we're in a critical point. And we can understand and appreciate and defend the principles that have brought us this far in such a short period of time. Democratic values, freedom of expression, innovation without permission, decentralization, voluntary standards, multi-stakeholder processes. Or we can see some power shift to the governments and to incumbents as well, to some extent, particularly in the telco industry, particularly internationally. So I urge you to support those of your colleagues who are participants in IETF. Support them as well with a little travel budget, if that's at all possible. Take a look at ITU and the issue of participating there and having either your university join or EDUCAUSE join or some of the other associations that you're participating in to get engaged. Take a look at our website where we have a range of resources on these issues and where hopefully we can keep you up to date. We have two people, right, one person coming back from Korea today and two people heading to Bali where there's a major meeting on internet governance that will be, this is just one day of the agenda in Bali on internet governance. So there is this ongoing global dialogue, and it's important, critically important, that we get it right. I think we have some time for questions. Thank you. Yes. You should use the mic, please, so people online can hear.
Thank you. This was a very revealing presentation, and I'll hope to talk to you afterward. But one quick question. Where is the Internet Society in the governance model?
The Internet Society is very good question. So the Internet Society is very deeply involved. First of all, the Internet Society is the administrative host, as I understand it, for the IETF. One of the remarkable things about the IETF is, as far as I know, it's not even incorporated. It doesn't even exist as a legal entity. It is hosted within the Internet Society. Also, the Internet Society, through its global chapters, has long sort of nurtured and served as a focal point for technologists, particularly from the university communities, but also from industry, technologists who care deeply about the policy aspects of the Internet as well as the technical aspects. And the ISOC is an important, I think, channel for people, particularly from countries outside the United States, but also inside the United States, but particularly outside the United States, for people to become involved in IETF, as well as ITU, as well as other internet governance structures. Please.
You mentioned briefly the problems of governments like China, the Middle East, Russia, sort of challenging the openness. But can you elaborate a bit more on the issue of governments who collaborate with some of the big companies like Google and Microsoft? You mentioned the sort of a credibility hole for the U.S., but I think that goes for any country, especially the European ones. But can you elaborate on how do you see that in the future, sort of avoiding that massive sort of weight that can be created by companies and governments joining together and controlling what is, for us, you know, geeks, has been sort of an open platform for nearly, you know, 30 years.
That is the critical question. And I think it's important to understand that we're not talking about no governmental intervention, and we're obviously not talking about no corporate power, since we've seen this remarkable growth in all of these amazing services that we now depend upon so intimately in our work lives and our personal lives. The question is whether it's governmental, whether it's standards-based, whether it's corporate. What are the driving principles? Are the driving principles interconnection, openness, interoperability, decentralization, the end-to-end principle, trust, respect for human rights, freedom of expression? Those, in many ways, whether they knew it or not, were the guiding principles that I see. That's what I see coming out of the structure that the structure that we've been working with. This structure. A lot of people engaged in this, even from the government side, cared about innovation, openness, interoperability, development, the end-to-end principle. And so I think whether it's government, technical, corporate, we need to look at what seem to be the values and what seem to be the values motivating this or that proposal, and what would seem to be the outcome of that proposal. Will it promote openness? Will it promote access? Innovate? Will it support innovation? Will it allow one-to-one and one-to-many communication of the traditional model? Other questions? Well, with that, thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your stay, and I welcome any contact or comments. Thank you.